So thank you for coming, and I'm really delighted to welcome Gregory Ledbetter here to Helen's. The Fetch is Gregory's first collection, and I have copies at the back that I can sell to you. His poems have appeared in the Poetry Review, Poetry London, The North, Magma, The Rialto, so lots of great, great magazines. And he also had a pamphlet published by Happenstance Press called The Body in the Well. He's written on Coleridge, Wordsworth, Keats, Charles Lamb and Ted Hughes. And Gregory currently teaches at Birmingham City University. So please join me to welcome Gregory Ledbetter.
Thank you. Thank you, Chloe, and thank you everyone for being here. It's great to be here. I'm going to start with a poem that isn't in The Fetch, actually. It's a more recent piece that was published on a website called New Boots and Pantisocracies, which some of you might come across. It's called Europa. It's as close as I come to topicality in my verse, generally. But it draws on the myth of Europa, which might be known to some of you. She was carried by Zeus disguised as a bull. He was often disguised as a bull. She was carried by Zeus from Phoenicia across the sea to Crete. Phoenicia, part of Phoenicia, is in modern-day Syria. And Herodotus, ancient historian, writes of how the alphabet came from Phoenicia. So there's sort of variety of links that kind of came together in my mind, fusing with the public events we're living through. Europa. We are estranged, a people spoken of as if in story. Our existence moot even to ourselves. Who are these figures behind our faces, and whose faces are these our own? Our stars are scattered king cups, light spilt like certain fate, for we the lost to find and build our firmament. Our beautiful are still beautiful, but cold as fresh statues waiting for the warmth of blood. We hold world office, our intent as yet unknown. We are old. We feel that in our bones and in the noises of our islands. There are voices on the air. Do they speak for us? Our mouths are silent, nestling crows, gaping to be fed. Our sounds require their dark interpreters. Our spectres tell our young, we come from over the sea. This movement between, this flood of our speech seeking us out. We wake to reports of a boat capsized beyond the horizon. We assemble in hope as if in sight of ourselves. A child washes ashore with her gift of tongues. She is alive. So all the rest do come from the book that I'm going to read tonight. This one's called Misterioso, which sort of takes up that theme of speech, I suppose. It was a commission, in fact, for an organisation called Music for Youth, who work with young people, a variety of concerts throughout the year, and this was to celebrate their 10th anniversary, holding their national sort of event in Birmingham. Misterioso, some of you might know, is a musical notation meaning play mysteriously, whatever that means. Misterioso. A shell at my ear, I heard the whisper of my heart's work. I fell open like a book. I watched the quiet of the moth's flight, drawn to silence like the moth to light, the life within the one we hear. Now I am the instrument that I play, and I am played by the sound I make, remade by the touch of the air, by the rhythm and note of what I say, as if the world is something I have found, and the world knows that I am there. And if the best of speech is music, a sense between the skin and something understood, returns the tongue to its own song, gives the blood its dream, let its language bring us close to the first of us, the cave of eyes, lit by the fire of what they heard, the drum that gives the ghost its dance, the voice that swells the earth like fruit, the cry that carries on the listening skies. This next one, what should I say about this? It's a peculiar piece. It's called Imp, it derives from the Old English word for a bud, or a graft, or a shoot, or a scion, or a child. I'll perhaps say more about it after, but I've read it. Imp. On the bad days, I shooed her muse away out of nothing but an absence of joy. I never installed a backdoor flap for her, so she would patter all night to get in at the window, while I lay, wide-eyed and sleepless, pretending not to hear. I know it was a blessing when she landed like a fly on my forehead as I was trying to write. Her cicada rustle, scribbling in and out, before the flick of my hand, sent her to hide in the plumbing, where she whined for weeks until I found her, toad shy and mourning blind, in the kitchen sink. I held her for the first time then, revived her with what has become her favourite wine. It has often been her game to go missing. It is where she thrives, as if she delights in being imagined, looked for in the fading light, or at the beck of a buzzard's call. In the garden, I would find her sprained, stinking of rotten fruit and putrid grain, the tang of iron and the fume of honeycomb. She would announce her return with a blackout bite through electrical cable, then creep in close, dab my eye with a spider leg to see if I was awake. She could drive me mad with her cuckoo blink. Then I remember how she would pull me out of the O of a dream when I couldn't breathe and make me a daybed from her sloughed skin. She would lap at whatever salt water leaked from me. It wasn't right for her to see me cry, but she would tongue my tears away, curl me a rabbit fur snake for a pillow, and blow through my ears. Her opalescent gaze could break the world egg open over and over again. Tonight, I will leave out a bowl of blood and marrow to tempt her back. Fall asleep on the sofa, wait for a child's hand to touch my face. Quite a number of my poems touch upon a kind of intimacy with the non-human or the inhuman, in that sort of punning sense of what's both within and beyond us. I suppose that's one of the poems that does that in this collection. And this next one is another. It takes the name of Homo Divivus, which is the name of a new species, which is about to be described, which I discovered on a walk near my house. Homo Divivus. I found it at the southern fall of Clough's Wood, a path I could not walk, without stones in my pockets to carry me down past the soft prints, sunk through the clutch of mud and under water and our breathing, where I could not go, but they had gone. Conditions were perfect. 3 days of dry weather, early April afternoon, the leaves of oak still to come. I had the luck of the wanderer, woken up by a thrush trying out all its notes, as if the combination would unlock a second sun. I have named the twice living as if they were human, but they are ultraviolet to visible light. What's the use of having found them, except to tell us that we do not know the world we inhabit? Even when they are so close, alter the earth in ways akin to us, though passing where we cannot, in sight of what we cannot see. They are in hiding from ignorance, withheld from us like plumage on a forest bird now extinct, a presence whose traces move us, whose pattern lives in other forms, the cuticle of beech and the flight between, the circuit of vine, verdigris lichen, the slant toe of sky, the rainbow sheen that blooms on the marsh, their anaerobic speech. To imagine them is to become like them, to haunt a place as they do, eyes too open, amoral as joy. I hear the hazel buds unfold, listen until, like them, I am diffused in Clough's wood, a shadow in sound, no more. Another woodland piece now. It's always woodlands and strange goings on. That's the theme, really, tonight with these ones I've selected, particularly the strange goings on. This one actually is called The Pact. I recently did a sort of blog post for the Nine Arches Press website about actually tracing its origins both to landscape, particularly a landscape around Wychbury Hill in Stourbridge, 9H Hillfort, near where I grew up. You probably know it, perhaps. Stourbridge, where I'm from. But also Stourbridge Library, in fact, which had a very... When I was a teenager, it had an extraordinary collection of what you call occult books, I suppose. And among these books was a book called Witchcraft, Magic and Alchemy by Cléon de Givry. And in this book, there were lots of these fantastic sort of 17th century woodcuts. And when I wrote this poem, it was those woodcuts of people meeting supernatural beings that was really in my mind. The pact. Pact as in a contract. A secret place was all the note said of where to meet. I chose the woods I walked, the time I lost the key to my house, returning to find a stranger asleep on my bed, who woke to say sorry, he got tired while waiting. Since then, I've been writing, letting the phone ring, dropping my friends. The work grew like a child between my daylight hours, a nine-month seal of shared blood, melted in the wax of a waning flame that tapered to a scrawl I knew was mine, telling me, go tonight. The figure in liquid silhouette stepped from the sky between a symmetry of silver birch, quiet as the morning star. Held in the split and dawn-red eyes, I felt the kiss of a voice on my throat sing through my skin with the touch of the air. I don't know how long I was weightless in the promise of those words. They thinned to silence as the sky paled. I stretched in the darkened sun, mindful of what would be waiting in my empty house, whether it would return this greater loss. there's a sequence in the book about my father, specifically his illness, the thing that eventually killed him. He died in 2013, vascular dementia. And it was one of those things, you know, you sort of, as a writer, you know, I knew I had to sort of face it at some point. So there's a sequence called Dendrites and Axons. I'll read one from that in a moment. But this one that I'm going to read next is called My Father's Orrery, which is the first time I was coming to terms with what was happening to him. So he'd ordered this orrery, you know, the model of the universe, solar system, not the entire universe, that would be a really big orrery. I'd like to see that. But this, so this was just the solar system, okay, manageable thing. And you know, you've got the planets going around the sun. So he'd ordered this sort of thing to arrive by post, you know, piece by piece. Anyway, he'd started to build it, but only got as far as Mercury, one planet out from the sun, before he couldn't go on. And actually, we didn't really know it at the time, but it was the disease. So this is that poem. My father's orrery is without end. The solar system on the fireplace spins only one planet around its sun. Mercury, as if now the limit of what we know, hints at the missing planets to come. The ache in the equation their absence makes. The skewed gravity at work in the hand that hoped to build a thing of beauty week by week, as the advert said, adding to the stock of wonder. Just a con, they are. Hasn't he got better things to spend his money on? But I shared the secret of his joy in those spheres, his maths by intuition, the theatre of their relative motion. He showed me the unopened packets, the grub screws, nuts and pinions of it all, and there the planets themselves. Jupiter, heavy as antique gold, the ball-bearing Earth, Saturn with its halo. A look of recognition crossed his eyes. Yes, that's them. But out of orbit, no force to order and bind them to the weave of their ellipses, to turn the key of the space between and spring them in the cradle of their star, without which they rattle and fall. With the planets in his hands, he felt the weight of his loss, knew he had forgotten how to put the universe together. So the sequence of eight poems follows that. It's called Dendrites and Axons, as I mentioned, and these are the brain cells that basically send and receive signals. They are the sort of communicative fabric of the brain, if you like. So as I say, there's eight of these. I'll just read one. So by this time, he was in a nursing home. It was quite advanced, really. Sort of hallucinations and things were afflicting him. There's someone else I mentioned in here, someone called Phil, who's another resident, who's always, whenever I arrived at the home, he's always seemed to be on his way out to the garden for a smoke. And there's nobody from here. The first time you didn't seem to know me. Even the carers never said hello. As if they knew I was now a cipher, a shadow companion to you. We move out of sync with the room like unsteady thieves through a crowd, when Phil, on his way for a smoke, grins over and says, "Hello, Doctor," then sits in the garden, lights up, oblivious. For a moment it's fun to be not what I am, and I laugh for the gift, akin to that first lost Christmas under greyscale skies, us going through the motions, you buried in the blizzard of eyes until the new year sprang in your sudden dance, that smile, forbidding morning. You hurry me past room 13. It's the devil. The matter of fact is subject to change. There are soft toys stuffed behind handrails whose cries can be heard all night. Which one of us cries out for the other not to go, tearing the air like paper? The goodbye that we haven't yet had, the goodbye that we are in. What's your name now? It has vanished into its component sounds, its other language, watchful as that woman in the corner, with her hands around her ankles and eyes black as dabs of tar that swallow what's left of the light. Your questions continue to arrive. You recognize a fellow ghost in me and ask, what killed you? Back home, mirrors imagine me alive. I seek consolation in a splash of water. Look up to see the face washed from me. I started a sequence on statues. I've written two. It doesn't constitute a sequence, does it? But anyway, the first two did make it into this book. The only two made it into the book. And this one is called Statuary, number one. You become a miraculous thing when blood soaks through your stone eyes, slow as wax from the candle nearby that marks the melting years. Scabs of lichen bloom across the bone-stiff drapery of your clothes, like mould on linen damp too long in the cold of a room without the sun. I have seen you move in candlelight, that trick in the flicker of a breath through flame that makes the livid brink of perfect stillness dance. Then, on days like this, you cry. I daredn't dab those tears away. I watch, instead, remember when your soft hand took hold of mine. One of the advantages of teaching, of course, in a university, teaching poetry, is you get to set your students really difficult exercises, like writing a villanelle. And then one day they say, are you going to write one as well? And I say, oh, all right then. This is the result of that occasion, called Feather. Here is the feather that knocked me down that dead sky morning. No other trace of the wing it lifted from the ground, but the swan-stark remnant that I found, which gave its colour to my face. Here is the feather that knocked me down. There's knowledge we don't know we carry around. I can only hold this feather displaced from the wing it lifted from the ground. It left me with nothing that day but the sound of my blood beating into empty space. Here is the feather that knocked me down. My father is not so old as I am now. This feather's perfection cannot replace the wing it lifted from the ground. But there's enough in its vein of barbs to astound his absence. Just enough fragmented grace to find in the feather that knocked me down the wing that lifts me from the ground. Feathers, yes. Birds pop up in my poems an awful lot. This next one I contributed to a collection called Bird Book by Sidekick Books. You might have come across it. And it's about the black-necked grebe. and possibly because I haven't actually seen a black-necked grebe in actuality, I kind of took a folkloric approach to it, really. There's a reference here to a cunning man, which, as you might know, is a sort of country warlock, if you like. So here is the black-necked grebe. They say it escaped from a cunning man's coop, dived into air one midwinter, and left him without spell or sight, to live unseen in its own season, behind the wind and water, waiting for the right crack of light to make its crystal feather, the black and rufous thing you see. I once came close, heard its whistle sheer off into the world that dogs can hear, that brings them running or drives them mad. What I'd give for a gold quill dropped from its head, or what the old man heard it whisper. On the fowl, in cold weather, they come to pan for its eyes. There's a note by Samuel Taylor Coleridge in one of his notebooks dating to October 1812. It's one of his most fantastic sort of pieces of self-analysis, really. And he's writing about his own experience of second sight, his phrase, second sight, which troubles him greatly. But he writes about how his own experience, he becomes fascinated by his own experience. He describes being fascinated by what he calls the transnatural, these transnaturals. And the transnatural is an old word, 16th century word, for the metaphysical, I suppose, that which is beyond the order of nature. Supernatural, but also simply something unusual or unexplained or hidden in some way. So he writes about his own fascination with the transnatural, and he goes on to say, in sort of hyper-condensed note, how actually that very fascination with the transnatural kind of alters him, causes him to become, as it were, something transnatural. Demonic, in fact, is the word. He says daimon. He writes it in Greek, daimon, to become daimon. And I write about Coleridge, as you heard, as you know, it's part of my sort of criticism and sort of academic life. And, you know, I suppose people often talk about conflict between the creative and the critical. But for me, actually, they really do have a common root. And I kind of recognise that, and I try to make sure that stays the case, you know, because I think if they start to come into conflict, it would cause me problems. So, So, one thing that I recognised in writing about Coleridge was my own fascination with the transnatural. So these last few poems, there's a lot of the transnatural in the Fetch, even the, as you can tell, really, this image. So these last four pieces, I'm going to read, all have that theme. This one's called Gibbet Lane. So there's lots of stories about gibbets, of course, and again, there's Gibbet Lane in Stourbridge, where I grew up, and there were lots of stories about that. This sort of, it's very obliquely related to those stories, but there's a connection, I dare say. Gibbet Lane. Yes, I should say there's a reference here to runes, as in, you know, the Germanic script, the ancient letters. Gibbet Lane. Cut the rune on the hanged man's tongue, and he will speak. Eat the days with you. Give your eyes the glare that sees where light is blind, but every truth intact. He hangs from the tree by the umbilical noose of his own birth, fruit of the coursing life of the dead, the teeming dark where the brain takes root. The human travels out of human shape in his fluent decay, chewed by babbling mouths into what we are without ourselves, water stripped to the fire of its elements. He breathes where the living lose their breath and gods dissolve with flesh. His acid sweet odour is an open flower to the speech you send beyond itself to take its nectar. Speak beyond our nature. His lips move with your own. Your question is his consummation and his crime. The knowledge taught at the hanged man's neck chokes on its own utterance as he cuts the rune on your tongue. This next one, Cradle, which is actually the final poem in the collection, it draws on my own interest in archaeology, I suppose, the strangeness of archaeology, the things that are out there in the landscape. And you know, there's sort of few things weirder than the archaeological record of these islands. And I became interested, you know, Seamus Heaney obviously has written about bog bodies in Northern Europe, and there are sort of equivalent things in these islands. And so I suppose this came from that connection, but it also has a kind of place behind it as well, Moseley Bog in Birmingham, known to Tolkien fans as a place that inspired Tolkien too. So this draws on these various things. I could go on, but I won't. There's a word in here, car, C-A-R-R, which is kind of a word for landscape of willow and alder, sort of marshy, wet landscape. Cradle. The bog is a beating fontanelle at the place I cast a penny wish, where car and fen leeches out an orphaned head for the fallen sun. Lowered, severed through this depth of thickened spring, drowned leaves from every heaven there has ever been, a glut of coal that runs with rain down the pouring face, sunk to stop its singing, to stop its crying, but still it cried when no one came. Too late for fright at who it is, the kisses lost on blackened lips, the mother and father whose ghosts cannot bear to look at what has become of flesh that outlives ritual, run to seed so powerful. Mouth and eyes as closed to mind as bone, but for the dark rhizome fruiting through their fetal sleep. The lit nerve that crazes the earth, the skull, its pale mineral. Soft and pulsing now, drawn like water from a spawning well, it is the foundling head I bring, that thinks the wish, that wishing grows a thing through which my tongue might leave its lair. There's no one here but me between the sensory trees, and the ecstasy that exceeds its birth, as I sink a voice to a singing head, as a white hand bursts from a limb of ash. Okay, from the end of the book to the opening now, this one. This is called Wisht, W-H-I-S-H-T, which might be known to some of you as a word for silence. It can also mean be silent, as in command, hush. But of course it has other connotations too, the eerie, the uncanny. This is the penultimate one, actual read. Wisht. Come to this clipping from my hair. Make a ring of a curl I wore. I've told you all the truth I know from the quietus of my pillow. When I speak your words, I feel you like a wish blown through a candle. Come to this, my bottled breath, warm enough for you to live. I take up a feather, air right to you, in magpie black and iridescent blue. I swallow the pips of an apple core to grow the godwise food you are. Come to this paper-cut bleb of my blood while it is here on my finger to suck. You know what you have taken from me, better than I have senses to see. I lay you a trail from a tomb to my door, in photographs, one for each living year. Come to this seed in the palm of my hand. I've held out my arm as long as I can. I dry out my sweat, leave you the salt of my fervid body, torrid or cold. I set a fire to bring the dawn and the far imago trying to be born. Come, I've given all you need of me. Spell out in silence my other name. I hold my tongue like a flame. Thank you for listening. This is the final poem now, which is a title poem, The Fetch. In case you don't know, fetch is a double apparition of a living person, kind of wraith-like thing. And this is based on a dream I did have. The fetch. The dream that slammed the bedroom door, but didn't break the film of sleep to tell the time, or give me more than broken promises to keep to phantoms that were never there, woke me just enough to know that something was, the restless air, the waveform of a note too low to hear, a song to raise the dead. I listened and began to speak as I am speaking now. My breath condensed. I saw it slowly take the outline of a child, afraid of the dark of which it was made. Thank you very much.
I feel kind of reluctant to speak and break the spell of it's, it seems almost incongruous to start to talk. And it's funny actually, because when we emailed each other yesterday, you emailed me and I emailed back and said, I was just thinking of emailing you. And I'd been reading these poems and this. So, I mean, the first thing I think it is, true to say, is there is the this atmosphere that is throughout the book, and this theme that you spoke about is really strong throughout the book. It's all the way through. And so I am curious to know and to hear more about you know, when you started writing these poems, how did it become a collection? Was it always going to have a very strong theme in it?
Yeah, I mean, the pieces in there actually are from quite a long term of years, actually. But the theme is there in my work and has been from the beginning, I suppose. So yes, that theme of the transnatural, if you like. And again, it's really Coleridge's fault, I dare say. Well, it isn't, is it? It's not his fault. But it was my discovery of Coleridge's, age 17, you know, that really sort of kind of catalyzed my brain to various possibilities to do with poetry, and that kind of metaphysical ambition that poetry can have, doesn't always have, but can have. And so that was one of the things that I just lit up at that, you know, from that stage. I did start writing, but it was really bad. I must burn all those notes from those years. But, you know, later on, as my writing developed, you know, it took these forms, many of which have found their way into the fetch. But when we were putting the book together, my editor, Jane Kermaine, and I, you know, one of the things that guided us really was the fact that it was coming through so strongly, the theme, that we thought, well, actually, yes, let's go the whole hog, as it were, and make that integral to this particular book, you know, so that it didn't just feel like a dispersed collection of this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. But I don't just write about that sort of thing, of course, but yeah, it was a concentration, I suppose, of that.
Right. So, and it's interesting because you said that Coleridge was almost got afraid of where he was going in with his work. So did you ever experience, I mean, did you experience that as you were involved?
Yeah, it brings out that superstitious sort of side, I suppose. Yes, and again, another poet that was important to me was you know, my early reading was Ted Hughes, and, you know, again, he's one for superstition, and so yes, it does. I did have that kind of experience of being haunted by these things, almost as if they are. I don't know. I think poems can sometimes take on that sort of life of their own, so they become like little intelligences that sort of follow you around and do haunt you. And yeah, it does. These things do tend to bring out that side of my thinking, I suppose. There's a lovely thing that Thomas Warton said in his History of English Poetry, 18th century, this was written, and he says the most poetical age was the Elizabethan age, because the Reformation hadn't quite driven away all superstition. And he says, reason still kept some demons in her service. Isn't that good? So, yeah, that's one of those things where I kind of recognise that my own practice.
That's interesting, because I did think that there are certain periods of time when people do tend to talk more about the ghosts or the supernatural side. So I think I read somewhere that after World War One, with the level of the amount of people that were killed, that was a time when people really... So there's a sort of sense of trauma and grief at the heart of that. Do you think there is a sense of that you might... that's what that seeking or looking or... Do you think, are we in that kind of period, or were you in a period?
Yeah, it comes in quite an unplanned way, of course, but yeah, I'm not sure. It is interesting that when I discovered a lot of, I told you earlier on about that library in Stourbridge that had all these extraordinary sort of books, sort of occult things, and then I realised that, you know, for a long time, a lot of what I was reading there did feel like a sort of private world. But then I noticed things popping up in the culture more generally that I recognised from that reading. And so I did think that there was a wave of interest in the zeitgeist for whatever reason. I'm not sure why. I mean, the connection with death is not something I can sort of point... I can't point to any one event in my own life particularly and say, yes, that has a direct correlation to what I ended up writing about. But I am interested in, if you like, that, you know, just that riddle of life and death, you know. I mean, it's the big themes, isn't it? And and how, you know, in a sense, the universe is kind of, you know, in a state of constant fusion of life and death, I suppose. And I suppose I'm interested in that fusion, that junction, and kind of exploring that through language.
Because when you are writing these poems, a lot of them have the sense of you dissolving or disappearing. And obviously, when you read the poem about your father, that was there in so there's that's something about an illness or a sort of, but also something in you, or is that right? Is there the two?
Yeah, that sort of dissolution.
Something.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think part of what you know, poetry, or the poetry I most enjoy, does, it gets past that kind of, what if you like, that kind of surface consciousness, you know, the ego, you might call it in kind of psychological terms, where, you know, which actually, of course, is the sort of front that is mostly sort of on display, and getting past that into sort of bigger realities that are kind of coursing through us all the time. I'm very interested in that, and I suppose those moments around birth and death, it is as if a door opens, or, you know, the veil thins. You know, I suppose that is certainly an experience I think many people might recognise.
And the kind of creative process, is that a bit sort of pushing into that? Because I did feel that a lot of the poems were also about the process of writing, of creative, of sort of drawing down inspiration and how what comes isn't what you might know, and then how that feels to, and it's like a dual life.
Yes, yes. I think for me, poetry, it's not so much about representing something that I already know, but about a kind of invocation. So a kind of summoning. So, you know, that those relationships with a kind of, you know, yeah, forms of invocation of whatever kind are, is definitely strong for me. And I like, again, for me, that's part of kind of exploratory nature of poetry, because you really don't quite know what is going to rise up from that experience or what's going to sort of attend upon you and the words themselves, yeah. But I do. I think poetry plays upon that kind of constitutive power of language, which is not just—it's not subordinate to a separate reality, but it actually constitutes reality. It has an affective, an affective power, a kind of that touches the physiological fabric of our being. So that's you know, it has a force. It has the force of reality when it's working well, I think.
Mm. Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, one of the ways that the collection is so brilliant is that it's building all the time this wonderful atmosphere with the poems, and then there's some, but they are things that we would all recognise. The dream is one, I think. I don't know if everyone would agree with that. That feeling, that dream state is something we would know about. There's another lovely one which you hadn't read, maybe you, I don't know if you'd remember, the baby monitor and listening to the baby monitor.
Sure.
The baby waking up. We'll hear a couple more before we close, because we want to end on poems.
Sure.
But the poem Wished is a wonderful, I mean, I love that poem. Where did that start?
Well, you know what? It started with the word itself, I think.
Right.
I think a few of my poems do. Just, I find etymology, you know, the history of words, absolutely sort of beguiling. And I find once you start digging into a word, you don't just get a sort of social history, but you also get a kind of history of consciousness as well, you know, through that. And that word, wished, with its various connotations, you know, it's obviously sounds like to wish, but also this notion of silence, which again is something that comes out quite strongly, I think, in my work, an interest in that. You know, was it Charles Simic who said a poem frames the silence? And, I like that notion of activating silence, so that again it's not a sort of emptiness, but actually a very pregnant sort of state, really. So I like this idea of a kind of pregnant, active silence that was actually a very palpable force, perhaps beyond the capacity of our capacity to name it. But yeah, that's where that one came from, was meditation on the word itself, I suppose.
That's interesting, because to me it also had a sense of a love, such a sense of a love letter being written and a yearning in it, which is
yes, again, I suppose that desire to access something that is otherwise very difficult to access. I think, again, that transnatural sort of theme is about sort of crossing that boundary. That word, you know, that the trans sort of transgressive kind of thing, where you're crossing kind of a boundary, you're becoming something different, but also continuous with what you are and were. That's, you know, that kind of impulse, I suppose, is very strong in that poem. And it's related to me, for me, with the impulse to know, to know the world and to know more, which again I think is a very, you know, ancient connection that poetry has with, you know, our knowledge systems. Our making of the world is a kind of, you know, that process of finding and making all at once. Again, that's something that poetry can do, and that that's what I look for in my own sort of entanglements of poetry.
You mean the meeting between the finding is the inspiration, the making is the craft, is that what you mean?
Well, that kind of coming together, yeah. So as you're kind of as you're in that process of seeking, if you like, of composing, you're kind of discovering things that might already be there, but you're also making something that wasn't there before.
Mm.
And somehow these things paradoxically are going on at one and the same time.
Mm.
Again, I think poetry is, you know, it can handle paradox in ways that kind of ordinary prose speech just struggles with. People's going to think, that doesn't make sense. Well, no, it doesn't. But you can get away with it. But it's not just a matter of getting away with it. It's actually sort of building it in, building that the kind of the fact of paradox, if you like, into a poem is something that interests me.
Does anybody else have anything they'd like to? Is there anyone got any questions or any thoughts that come up here?
Transnatural.
Oh.
Does terror come into that?
Terror. Yes, I think certainly in that kind of, are you thinking of that sort of Burkean sense of terror and the sublime?
No, I'm thinking terror as a physical thing that grabs you.
Yeah, I think it can do. I think fear is very closely related to the imagination.
I'm sorry, but it isn't.
Well,
you can control, but terror you can't.
Sure. But I was just going to say, I think the kind of roots of, I think terror is related to fear, isn't it? So I think they have a connection in the experience, in the imaginative experience, if you like. I think the terror comes, I suppose, when it's feels so completely other to yourself that actually you're totally out of control. I think that can be part of it. It's not necessarily part of it, but it can be. Mm. Certainly for Coleridge it was, I think, at times. And actually if you look at Dr. Johnson, you know, Samuel Johnson, he was terrified, and I think that is the word, of his own imagination at times. He wrote about it a lot.
Mm.
He wrote, that fear that imagination would tip you into insanity, essentially. So there is a relationship.
Because I would have noticed an anxiety. What I sensed in the book, sometimes there's a sort of anxiety of that, which was to do with the dissolving sense sometimes, that's sort of there, like as if the self is getting lost
as
the poems are being made.
Again, it's that paradox of that being both a desirable state in some way, but also something that actually is, you know, it's like a one or a zero, isn't it? It's either kind of, a sort of fulfilment of, in a sense, or at the other end of the spectrum, annihilation.
Mm.
And those two things can kind of, again, haunt each other.
Mm.
And
there's definitely one poem that's scary. Most of the poems are not. I'm, you know, somebody who is quite scared of things like woods and dark places and wells and. But the poems are not did not induce. But there is the one that did make. I was like, if I read that on my own late at night, with the baby being born a bit from the doll.
Oh right,
and the parents making. Yeah. That was probably the one which to
cradle.
Me came near to sensing a terror.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that because it's, you know, even though I'm always interested in the reactions, I don't sort of set out to be a horror writer.
No, I know.
But I don't mind that. It seems wrong if I say I don't mind that you're afraid. but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Did anyone else want to say anything? Ask anything? Yes.
A question about the relationship between poetry and your criticism.
Mm.
You said that you try to keep them coming from the same place. And I know you said that in poetry you're allowed to have paradox, so you're allowed to have something that can't be reduced to prose. So how do you stop them from being in conflict with each other?
Yeah, I suppose, in my criticism, I try and find ways of articulating. So, in a way, what I've just said is a kind of criticism as opposed to a poem, of course. So, so I suppose that's how I do it, really, is how I just did it, in that I tried to find a way of writing about these things as well as sort of embodying them in verse. And certainly, you know, Coleridge is such a mercurial character, but you know, lots of the romantics and, you know, Ted Hughes and other authors that I've written about have those qualities. So you kind of have to find a way of dealing with it. And I suppose... I really try not to. I think something's gone horribly wrong if I've killed a poem off. Yeah. I'm very keen for criticism to be imaginative writing in itself. So, you know, William Blake says he wants writing. He was talking about poetry, but he said he wants it to rouse the faculties to act. It's a great, great phrase. And in a way, that's what I think criticism should do as well. So if that's happening, then the criticism is working in ways that I would want it to work. If it's suffocating a poem, I'd be mortified and I'd immediately retire. So I really go out of my way to avoid that and just to cultivate a different way of... cultivate the way that I want it to be. Yeah.
Anybody else like to? Got a, probably time for maybe one last thought.
You talked earlier on, Gregory, about the poem Framing the Silence.
Oh, yes.
Which I think you said is...
Charles Simic, wasn't it? Yeah, if I'm remembering right.
As you said that, I was thinking about maybe the silence framing the poem, in the sense that the white space around the poem is a frame in itself. And then I started thinking about, well, what else is framing the poem? And it's titles as well. There's a title. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the only door handle that we have on the poem. And I wondered if you could say something about how you come to decide on the title. Do you, because I mean, it's a question that I wrestle with myself, do I write towards a title, or is that restrictive? Or is the title something that I just sort of pick out of the poem afterwards? Or in what way can we sum up the poem or lead the reader into the poem without... giving too much away?
Yeah, it's a perennial difficulty, isn't it, for anyone. I like the idea of a title being a companion to the verse that follows, so that it doesn't sort of stand for it exactly, but it sort of is like a sort of signpost saying, you know, there's something down here. But of course, sometimes titles can be very much part of the poem. I mean, that one I read, My Father's Orrery, that's one of those pieces where the title is sort of the first half of the first line, if you like. But that worked in that context, and, you know, it very much depends on the specific sort of... You have to build a fresh workshop for each poem, don't you, really?
Mm.
And I think that's the same with title. I mean, some pieces... I've just given up on. I mean, there's a piece I wrote, not yet published actually, but I just cannot pin it to a title. So I thought, okay, it's just going to be one of those poems that the first line is going to be repeated as the title. I don't know if that's copping out, but again, there's not every poem that I would do that with it, but that particular piece, I'm happy to do that, I think. But yeah, it's very often not the first thing that happens for me. It's generally something that happens later in the process of drafting, arriving at the title. But then again, you know, it can be a stimulating thing just to set yourself something quite arbitrary, can't it? Actually, just to work towards, to write towards, as you say. So I'm afraid there's a whole multiplicity of practice in it, among my own sort of ways of going about things, but I suspect it's a perennial thing for all of us. Yeah.
Thank you. I agree with you that it's better to use the first line rather than force the title. Sometimes we force the title, and it somehow is then it works against, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The body of the poem.
Yes.
So I think it's much better to have the first line.
Particularly if it veers off into something abstract.
Exactly.
Yeah, that can sort of have a loosening effect on the poem itself, I think. Yeah. Mm.
Well, then I think it's time to close. Would you like to give us one last poem?
Well, I think you mentioned Baby Monitor, and I think I will.
Fish for that, really.
No, you know what? I wanted to do it. So after our conversation in the car, Chloe mentioned it in the car.
Oh, yeah.
I should. Yeah. Okay. So well, thank you again. It's been a real pleasure. So this is a short piece, Baby Monitor. In a way, it's kind of a series of little clues. It's almost like a puzzle, I suppose. It's not your average Baby Monitor experience. At the nudge of a shadow, the lamp is lit. The empty house to the would-be thief. I'm home. The kettle's cold, everything unplugged, all but the fridge with its chuckle and hum, and the baby monitor left on. A fizz in the air from the bedroom to the lounge. At a certain hour, the lamp goes out, and a sound comes feeling for the light. The speaker downstairs is breathing, very gently tells the darkness, I'm awake. Thank you very much.
Okay.